Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee for Thursday, March 8th. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazerall. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel.
Here.
Representative Lane. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling. Representative Shoemaker.
Hi.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
Present.
Okay, a quorum is present. We have a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
So moved.
Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay, first bill on our calendar this morning is House File 2491. Welcome to our committee, Representative Kelly. What's the motion on this one?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly, give us a minute to move your bill.
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Hillstrom moves the bill. What's the destination for your bill? Where do you need to go next?
To the floor.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 2491 with the recommendation to pass and to be sent to the General Register. Representative Kelly, proceed with your bill introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2491 is really a clarifying bill. There's some ambiguity in the current statute. So the domestic abuse no contact order really clarifies that it is a criminal procedure. We're not changing the definition. It's just that it, like I say, was ambiguous in statute. It also, the other change is that the order could actually be given during the same proceeding that the decision was made, also going towards efficiency in the courts. And I will have Ms. Richards explain a little bit of the statute. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and your position and give us your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. The Domestic Abuse No Contact Order, the DANCO, was created by statute in 2000. And the DANCO is widely used in criminal domestic abuse cases to provide protection to domestic violence victims at one of the times that is most dangerous, one of the most lethal times for victims. In 2010, as part of the Domestic Abuse Omnibus Bill, a number of changes were made to the DANCO statute, and those included moving it from the family law statutes into the criminal statutes. And as part of this process, a paragraph concerning separate proceedings was added. There were a number of other changes to the DANCO, but this bill doesn't concern those changes. Since 2010, there's been much discussion and a number of concerns about the DANCO statute. Those concerns fall into two categories. There are some questions about constitutionality of the statute, and there's also confusion over some of the process that's set out in the statute. This proposal does not touch those constitutional issues, but rather deals with the procedural questions. Over the summer and the fall, the coalition has convened many people to look at the statute and to discuss it. This has included city attorneys, county attorneys, law professors, legal advocates, and a few judicial officers. This bill is based on the consensus of those people. So we're not asking for any changes that would touch the constitutional issues because there is currently a case up on appeal that will give some direction as to whether there are some constitutional problems and what direction should be taken with those. But rather, the consensus is that these changes are needed in the meantime. While the appellate case is moving through the system, there's still confusion at the district court level. And these two changes would certainly assist with a day-to-day business going on in district court in the meantime. So the changes are two. There's the insertion of the word criminal to make sure that this is a criminal order issued in a criminal proceeding. And the other is striking the paragraph separate proceedings. It's not necessary in the statute. It's led to much speculation and confusion about what was meant by the language. Some of those confusions have been, is there a difference between a proceeding and a hearing? What is actually meant by separate? Is the DANCO a separate court proceeding and therefore needs a separate filing document, a separate case number? Does public defender appointment attach and extend into the separate proceeding? Those are just a few of the problems. So the consensus is, among those who have participated in discussions, that these changes, while not addressing the constitutional issues, will certainly lend clarity to the statute and be helpful at the district court level.
Great. Thank you. Representative Kelly, do you have anyone else that would like to testify on this bill?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 2491? If so, please step forward and provide us with your testimony. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Harrison. I'm the Executive Director of Judicial Common Sense, and I'm here to testify against this bill. As Ms. Richards explained to you, there is a appellant case, and we agreed that Judge Paul Benshoof out of Beltrami County has already ruled that this statute is unconstitutional. And our thought is I'm a little confused to why we have this bill at this point. I did not know if I would testify today because, again, I'm a little confused. I guess the only thing that I would say, if there is constitutionality questions with this, I would wait to see what the court's going to say about it or what their findings will be before we would go ahead and do anything with this law, because, again, we're just going to be back here again, you know, maybe not this year, but next year, rehashing over this. And so I would encourage you just to let the court handle it at this point and see what happens. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Okay. We have a couple of questions. Just please stay at the table. Okay. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Harrison, just a few questions about your group. Frankly, I have not heard of the group Judicial Common Sense. Can you share with me how long that's been in existence, and do you have a membership roster?
No, we do not have a roster. I started this group about 6 years ago with two retired attorneys. We've grown to about a group of 17 attorneys. The reason why we don't have a roster is because it is made up of attorneys. We have a couple issues that they are concerned about. Number one is confidentiality. Most of our stuff comes to their clients. Number two, the attorneys are concerned about retribution by the courts, because we do testify against judiciary issues and constitutional issues, which we feel that are against the judiciary, because we are concerned about the judicial system in the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Harrison, I really didn't want to see the roster or know who's on it. I was just interested in how many people belong to or consider themselves members of Judicial Common Sense. And I hear you saying that 17 of you. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mr. Chairman, one final question.
Representative Smith.
Does Judicial Common Sense have a mission statement other than opposing this bill? What's your goal?
Mr. Harrison.
Our goal right now is, like I said, we started about 6 years ago. We started out the reason why we came with common sense was we go back to Thomas Paine and how he issued articles to the people of this country to actually build this country. So we took that initiative, and we started out by just writing articles. We really didn't feel that was going any place, so I started coming down here as a representative, as a paralegal, so I'm not governed by any board by any
Mr.
means.
Mr. Harrison, thank you. I think that kind of covers the topic.
Mr. Chairman.
State to the subject of the bill, Representative
Smith. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Right.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
No questions for him, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment about the business.
All right, great. All right. Representative Hillstrom, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this was part of the Omnibus Public Safety Bill that I carried. I think it was originally Representative Paymar's bill, and it actually came from folks who actually do this line of work. I can tell you that it currently does cause issues in court. Folks don't know if there's supposed to be a separate proceeding or what that separate proceeding is supposed to be, and people are doing it differently across the state. I think it's really important to have this clarification so that we have some uniformity and folks really know what the process should be.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, maybe for the author or maybe for the testifier from the Battered Women's Coalition, but I just two questions, actually, Representative Kelly. One is, I heard that there are a lot of groups that have worked this through, and that's great. I didn't hear anything about the defense bar or anybody who would be thinking about it from that side. That's number one. And then secondly, I'd just like to understand a little bit better the effect of making this a criminal order rather than a civil order. And I get the thing about the separate proceedings, and that's fine, you know, but I'm just, is there anything else that comes along with it being a criminal order?
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, first of all, we're just stating that it is a criminal order. We're not changing that it is currently a criminal order. We're just stating in the language so it's not ambiguous to clarify. And as Representative Hillstrom said, there are a number of issues that it causes for the courts. And even the past testifier, you know, they're using the word common sense. Common sense says we still have to process these. We do not speak to the constitutionality at all specifically because of that, but the courts still have to process these cases, so they need to know that, the correct language so that it clarifies them to continue the process.
All right. Ms. Richards, did you have any additional?
I'll just address the other question. The public defenders were not directly involved in the discussions, I can tell you that. The County Attorneys Association, various county attorneys, city attorneys. I know that the defense bar was aware. A lot of stuff went through emails, but they did not directly participate in in-person discussion.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just to clarify, but there hasn't been any objection from them either. Nobody's raised any red flags about this.
Ms. Richards.
Chair, we've heard no objections from anybody around this change in the bill.
All right. Any further questions? Seeing none, we will proceed to vote on the passage. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2491 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion is passed. Congratulations, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. We're going to just deviate slightly from our agenda this morning. We will next take up House File 68 with Representative Garofalo. All right. Do we have a motion to bring the bill before the committee?
Mr. Chair, if I would like to move
Representative Cornish.
House File 68 and recommended to pass and move to
Ways and Means.
Ways and Means.
All right. Welcome, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 68 is a bill that most members of the committee should be aware of. Under current law, when an individual is careless or negligent in their driving and caused the death of an individual, under current law, there is either a misdemeanor charge or a felony charge. The felony charge bringing with it a burden of proof of gross negligence. What this bill would do is it would create a third way, a middle way, so that only in a situation where the actions of an individual result in the death of another result in the death of a person, there'd be a gross misdemeanor charge, so it'd be the option of being charged with. And Mr. Chairman, if now's the appropriate time, I have a couple testifiers who wish to testify.
Certainly, Representative Garofalo, call for your first testifier. Welcome to the table.
Good morning.
Morning, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in connection with this important bill. This is a change in the law that I and many other prosecutors and those who work in law enforcement have been pursuing for a number of years. We have seen far too many tragedies. I can tell you in Dakota County, we've had six to seven of cases involving careless driving that has resulted in death, in some cases multiple deaths, where the only charge that we were able to bring forward and obtain convictions on was careless driving, which is a misdemeanor, as Representative Garofalo has indicated. It's simply not appropriate when the level of harm involves death for the penalty to be the same as if the driver drove negligently and struck a mailbox. It's very difficult for a prosecutor such as myself to explain to a victim's family who have lost a loved one under these circumstances that that is the only possibility to pursue. Proving gross negligence under the law is a very difficult task. It requires proof of very great negligence, acting without even scant care. It is something that we have attempted in a number of these cases over the years, but we have not had the success in the vast majority of those situations where alcohol or drugs are not involved in the crash. You know, these are not unavoidable accidents. These are situations where drivers are driving without due care, texting, falling asleep behind the wheel, you know, just total lack of control of the vehicle in terms of the surroundings. That, you know, these are not unavoidable accidents, and they do need to reflect, I believe, in the law, an appropriate penalty, a more appropriate penalty than we currently have, and we're asking that that become a gross misdemeanor. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Johnson, did you have a question at this time?
Yeah, just a couple brief questions. Representative Garofalo, is there a fiscal note with this bill?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, there is, and the current fiscal note is $4,000, so that's why it's going to Ways and Means, but my understanding is that previously there's been on an identical bill zero fiscal note, a $0 fiscal note from the department, so that's something that they're taking a second look at, but just because of we want to be careful with this, we're going to send it to Ways and Means until that process is officially resolved.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, do we have
Johnson.
That fiscal note?
We do.
It's in the packet. Okay. I guess I just didn't see it. And Mr. Chair, to testifier, Mr. Backstrom, are you speaking for yourself and your experience? Are you speaking for the County Attorneys Association?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which has endorsed this change in the law for a number of years. They certainly have endorsed this change.
Right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't judges already have the leeway to use sentencing guidelines to enhance penalties if they think the aggravating factors require such? And wouldn't that address the issue that we're talking about here?
Mr. Backstrom.
Representative, no, it would not. Sentencing guidelines apply to felony-level offenses. Under Minnesota law, they do not apply to misdemeanor level crimes. So, you know, that's really a non-factor in connection with cases of this nature.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Representative Cornish used to say that he can remember back in a time when the only gross misdemeanor around was bear baiting. Was that you, Representative Cornish? Well, it was someone that's been around for a while. No offense. But in law enforcement, and we didn't used to have a lot of gross misdemeanors. Well, my question is there a local impact note? And I always ask this whenever we're changing misdemeanors to gross misdemeanors, because there's a hidden cost in there for local units of government in increasing both bail, both the terms of release, and costs associated with local government. So I'm wondering if that's been taken into consideration here.
Representative Garofalo or Mr. Backstrom?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I'm not aware of a local impact note on this, but I could be mistaken.
Okay. And Mr.
Representative
Chair, if I
Lesh.
Could, I'll just use this as the bully pulpit. This happens to be the bill, but every time we do that around here, we're changing misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. We think we can get by. This has a small fiscal note, but in fact, there is a much broader impact in the local impacts of notes of these bills, which oftentimes aren't considered in this committee. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
I have additional testifiers. I'm wondering if it would indulge the chair if we could have those testifiers complete their testimony before the members' questions.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, would you be willing to wait?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, are your next testifier? Morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Mac Backlund. I'm the state coordinator for American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education. We go by the acronym ABATE of Minnesota, and we are the largest motorcycling advocacy group in the state of Minnesota. As you've heard, every year, motorcyclists, pedestrians, bicyclists, and all the other road users are killed by motorists who enter the roadway into their path, turn left into their path, or otherwise cause crashes while failing to yield the right of way. Hoping to save a few seconds of time, their actions lead to tragedy and heartache on the families that they impact. Currently, these are misdemeanor citations, as you've heard, and as long as the driver is found to be sober and drug-free. Those who are cited are simple misdemeanor violation. ABATE of Minnesota feels that Minnesota should strengthen the penalties for those who kill others while driving in a negligent manner and raise the offense to the level of gross misdemeanor. Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing the bill, and Representative Garofalo, thanks for carrying the bill. And members, I urge you to vote yes on HF 68. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Backlund. Now we have another testifier who is wishing to come forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Johnson. I'm president of Minnesotans for Safe Driving. Many of our members have had loved ones killed or injured in non-alcohol-related crashes, many of them distracted driving. You've heard their stories before. I have many of them that could have testified, but I know that you sympathize very much with their plight, and this bill is very, very important to them. There are a few other reasons why we believe this bill should be passed. This change will illustrate to the public the seriousness of negligent driving, just as enhancing the penalties did with drunk driving back in the 80s. It was very acceptable back in the 80s to drink and drive, and when changes were made and things got tougher and people changed their idea, things happened. Hopefully, with the combination of stiffer penalties and more awareness as to the result and consequences of negligent driving, the number of deaths and injuries will decrease as the public accepts their personal responsibility to follow the laws of the road and keep their distractions to a minimum. The offender would be on probation longer, with conditions given regulating their driving behavior and more penalties to be given, such as jail time and fines. Also, with this change, the offender must appear in court and the prosecutor must be involved in the case, unlike what can happen now if the charge is too low and the prosecutor doesn't get involved. The change in the law will help victims feel that the court system and the public perceive the seriousness of the crash that killed or seriously injured their loved one. It wasn't a tragic accident. It was a preventable crash, and the actions of the driver was criminal. This change would only be involved with things that were negligent, not accidental deaths, and there are very few accidental deaths. Crimes committed in Minnesota pertaining to property loss, injury, or death of a person are enhanced based on the amount of property taken or the seriousness of the injury, except with non-alcohol-related traffic deaths and injuries. If the crash was caused by negligence, it should be treated as a crime. I think it's time for a change, and we hope that you pass this bill. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Other questions? Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the hearing. That concludes the testifiers that I am aware of as part of our presentation. And I just neglected, I always make a point of talking about this bill. This is Jackie's bill. This is in honor of Jackie Devney, a young lady from Farmington who was unfortunately died in an accident in the Farmington area. And the person who caused her death was actually charged with a misdemeanor. So that's I always make a point of mentioning that, and I neglected to do that in my opening statements, that this is House File 68, is Jackie's bill.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. So noted. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Garofalo, we've seen this bill for many, many, many years. It started off just with motorcycles, And if you did something and it caused injury to just someone driving a motorcycle, they were the only one who got the increased penalty. Then it has changed over the years. So previously we didn't have the County Attorneys Association on board on the bill, and now I'm hearing that the County Attorneys Association is on the bill. This is the first time that I've actually seen any others coming to support the bill other than Abate Minnesota. So, you know, I have had some concerns in the past because what it did was treat people differently based on the kind of vehicle they were driving. In the past, you've taken care of that issue. But do you believe that this will result in fewer felony penalties being charged because the gross misdemeanor will be the easier one to prove rather than going for the felony when it's kind of a close call?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you for the question, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I do not believe that. That is not my intent. I don't believe that will happen. As County Attorney Baxter mentioned in his opening statements, the gross negligence standard is a very difficult standard to prove, and it's exceedingly rare under current law. So, no, I do not believe that is not a concern I have.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a question of Mr. Baxter?
No, you may not. No.
Welcome, Mr. Baxter. Representative Hillstrom, proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Baxter, actually, you're moving me. I mean, I was absolutely opposed to this bill when we first saw it from just the perspective of motorcycle drivers, and so you're moving me. So what I'm asking is, do you know how many cases you've seen in your career, however long it's been, that would have been changed by this provision? Because we don't like to just put stuff in statute that doesn't really matter.
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I can tell you just in Dakota County alone, since the tragedy with Jackie Debney that Representative Garofalo mentioned, which occurred in 2006, in the last 5.5 years, we've had 7 cases that resulted in misdemeanor convictions for individuals who struck and killed another person while driving negligently, and that's just Dakota County alone. I can tell you these cases occur across the state every year, multiple times, unfortunately and tragically. So, in several of the cases in Dakota County, in 2 of them, there were 3 individuals that were killed in each of those incidents. So these are often involve multiple deaths and not just a single death. So. You know, we've had close to 10 to 11 deaths in Dakota County in the last 5 years that would have been, or have been, unfortunately, had to been dealt with as misdemeanor cases because of the laws we currently have.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you also clarify for me, are these people who, you know, bent down and changed the radio station or were eating a cheeseburger or... You know, that's what a lot of folks have always said over the years, right? That this is people who are just doing regular things that people do when they're driving their car. What assurance can you give to the folks here that, in fact, that's not the case, and these are actually people who are doing something other than what regular people do when they drive?
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I can tell you that in one of the cases, I guess in the Jackie Debney case, the driver fell asleep behind the wheel. And I truly believe that it is, unless you're suffering from a sleep apnea type of an illness, falling asleep behind the wheel is something that you have some anticipation of, and yet you continue to drive. And I think that's a significant situation. It's not an unavoidable accident. We've had cases involving people that were taking pictures with cameras and passing cameras back and forth where they lost control of the vehicle crossing the center line in Invergrove Heights on Highway 52, killing 3 individuals in 2009. We've had cases involving speeding and missing stop signs. Those are just some examples, and I also believe, and I truly believe that, judges will take into consideration the level of the negligence involved. And the types of cases that you're referring to where you simply drop something on the floor and you reach down to pick it up, you know, certainly none of us condone distracted driving of any type, because the tragedies that occur can be enormous. But I do believe that judges will take into consideration the level of the negligence involved when they make their sentence. A gross misdemeanor penalty, I think the most important thing that it does is it brings to the victim's family some measure of understanding that this tragedy that was caused by another person's negligence, is death that was caused by another person's negligence, is more serious than negligence that results in property damage. And right now, the law treats them exactly the same. And I think our judges will balance this when they do issue a sentence. There's no mandatory sentence for a gross misdemeanor. It could be up to a year in the county jail. A misdemeanor could be up to 90 days in the county jail. I suspect that there will not be significant changes, quite frankly, in the amount of time spent behind prison. But what this bill also does is to give us the opportunities to have longer periods of probation for these offenders, so they can get driver training, education, some help to address these things, to try to avoid these types of tragedies from occurring again. And again, it just shows that our criminal justice system is recognizing that the level of harm should be a factor in deciding what the penalty should be.
Thank you. No further questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a lot of questions about this. I mean, first of all, and some of these have been addressed a little bit since I raised my hand, but the first one is kind of, will this really help? I mean, I understand the point about, you know, in the area of criminal justice, you know, often you can't do enough for a victim's family, because if it's your own tragedy, you know, you want to kill that person if you could, often, you know, so... While I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that, I don't think that should be our primary consideration as we make these kinds of decisions. But so I guess I'd like a little bit more about the main issue for me is, does this help prevent these kinds of tragedies? And nobody's mentioned anything about the fact that you can file a civil suit. So I think that the serious, now I recognize, I'd see the look on Representative Garofalo's face.
I'm sorry, Representative Liebling.
I realize that, you know, the person may not have assets, so it may not be worthwhile to file a civil suit. But I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, do the people who have, you know, had this happen and killed somebody through their own negligence, you know, how do they respond? Mr. Backstrom, do they take it lightly? Do they say, "Oh my God, I've killed somebody"? I mean, I just really wonder if we need to increase the potential level of the offense to have that kind of impact. And going forward, I personally don't believe that people look at the statute book and say, "Well, I'll pay more attention because it'll be a gross misdemeanor instead of a misdemeanor." I mean, I just don't think that's human nature. So that's kind of what I'm getting at. Are we really going to do anything going forward to make this not happen? Or should we really be doing something else, like banning cell phone use while people drive and stuff like that, that would actually really have an impact? So that's my question.
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I understand your concerns. I understand your question. I too, think that... There are many forms of distraction behind the wheel that we can do more on in terms of prevention. I believe that the use of cell phones is extremely dangerous while driving, and perhaps it is time in our state to consider enacting a law that would prohibit the use of cell phones while driving. I do believe, as Ms. Johnson said when she testified, that enacting this law is a step in the right direction. I think it's a step in the direction of recognizing and I think more people will pay attention to the fact that they need to be more careful when they're behind these powerful automobiles that we drive every day, oftentimes without a lot of thought while doing so. And I do think that this will be a step in the direction, just like increasing some of the penalties for drunken driving have been over the years in terms of raising the level of awareness, and I think we've done some remarkable things in reducing the deaths and serious injuries in our state due to drunk driving, in large part because of the increased penalties imposed by our law for those crimes and the recognition that comes with it. And I think that this will result in greater recognition of these types of dangers, these distracted driving type of dangers behind the wheel. And so from my perspective, I think it will help.
And next we have Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, do you believe that when a driver kills someone on the road because of their actions, that justice demands some time in jail?
Representative Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I, in most cases, would argue for some jail time. In these types of cases, it's not always imposed. Even for misdemeanors, there could be some jail time. And you know, one of the cases I mentioned to you recently in Dakota County that resulted in three deaths and two serious injuries involving someone passing a cell phone or taking pictures back and forth with the passenger in the car and losing control of their vehicle, she received no jail time. We recommended that she receive 90 days in jail in that particular case for causing three deaths and seriously injuring two children. So again, I think you know our judges will have to weigh this this sort of thing. But in most cases, I think a short jail term when a life is taken is not is something that is appropriate.
Mr. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Backstrom, in your last previous testimony, you said that you think judges do take into consideration the circumstances of a case and wouldn't impose too much time. And then you also testified after that that you don't anticipate that this change in law would result in a change in the amount of time that people spend in jail. So I'm wondering how you square those two statements. Are judges going to use this law to impose more jail time, or aren't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, could they do that? Yes, they could. Do I think there'll be substantial changes in the amount of jail time served in these types of situations? I do not think so. But again, it's up to the discretion of judges and the facts of a given case. And I do believe that judges will take into consideration, as I said earlier, the extent of the negligence involved and weigh that in their decision-making process. As to whether jail time should be imposed. It's not just the jail time, though. As I said before, it can be longer periods of probation with a gross misdemeanor. There can be some other requirements that are imposed for the offender to do community work service during that period of probation, which can be 2 years instead of one. So I think you know that's an important factor when a death is caused, and I think that would be something that certainly would occur with the, if this legislation passes.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can think of at least four occasions over the course of the last 11 years where I've had to explain to a family why the death of their loved one results in a misdemeanor charge. And that's always a difficult conversation to have, especially, I mean, there are varying responses, of course, but I just wonder if it, changing this would make that conversation any easier. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, for those of you that are having a hard time voting for this because you think it's just a little accident, we could use the same analogy for the person that comes home with a handgun on his hip and takes it off and puts it in the drawer and doesn't unload it. It was just a simple mistake. No way did they ever intend to hurt anybody by their negligence. But yet two kids pull it out and one of them dies because of that simple mistake. And another one is when somebody comes home from hunting. It's just a simple mistake. I forgot to unload the rifle. And they put it away and two kids get it down and one dies. So County Attorney Backstrom, isn't it true in cases like these where the actors have just considered those simple little mistakes that we end up with pretty serious charges of reckless endangerment or endangering a child or manslaughter? If somebody's cleaning a gun, they forget to, and you've seen this happen, I'm sure, in your career. Someone's cleaning a gun, they made a simple mistake, they forgot to unload it. the person standing next to him dies. And so what seems to be a simple mistake is just a little bit of negligence where they didn't intend to hurt you. Somebody dies and the whole family is affected and somebody gets charged with a felony. So I don't realize why we have to minimize this. If somebody's in charge of a 3-ton missile going down the highway, and just to say, oh, I was just talking on my cell phone, I didn't mean to kill those four people. So is it true that we charge people for this?
Mr. Beck.
Simple mistakes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, yes, we do. I mean, there are many crimes that involve negligence that results in death. We call that manslaughter, if the facts exist, if it's culpable negligence. In terms of those types of situations. And I'll also just mention to you, I think your analogy is a good one, because right now we have laws on the books in Minnesota that make the reckless handling of a gun or a dangerous weapon a misdemeanor. But if it occurs in a school or a public housing zone or a park zone where there's more potential harm that's possible, it becomes a gross misdemeanor. So I just think that we have a number of cases, a number of statutes on the books that increase the penalty when even the risk of harm increases. And in this case, we're talking about actual serious harm, death of an individual. So I certainly think it's appropriate to have
Representative Cornish. I think it will make a difference because I think as people found out, they leave guns laying around without unloading them or they're careless. I think it's made a difference in the storage of them, the number of locks that's put on them. And I think it'll make a difference. This is a great bill that people start thinking the next time they talk on their cell phone or they're doing this and that and they're going down the highway and they have a little bit of a close call or whatever, like many of us have doing that, they'll start to think, ooh, this could get a lot more serious now, and they remember this news media or this bill. So thank you.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm actually for it's a rare day because Representative Cornish is convincing me. So I'm kind of, really, what is wrong? Maybe it's time to quit here. I'm thinking, aren't there some things that we ought to do, though, maybe in addition or possibly even instead of doing it this way? Because, I'm getting the point here, but, why don't we specify some things, like if you're on a cell phone or if you're texting for sure? I mean, we made texting illegal. I don't remember what the penalty is for that. But, there ought to be certain things that if you're doing them, that it's, we know if you're drinking, that you know that you made the choice to drink. You know if you made the choice to talk on the phone. You know if you made the choice to, do a lot of, eat a cheeseburger while you're driving. So maybe we ought to specify certain things somewhere in law that give people more of a warning, because I think what kind of troubles me about this is that the determination is really after the fact. How negligent were you? And so I just kind of want to throw that out there, but
Mr. Chairman and
Representative Groffel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, rarely is there only one way to solve a problem, and usually it's a portfolio of options that are before us to solve things. And certainly one of the things we can do a better job, and this is leaving the scope of this bill, is all of us can just, with friends, mm-hmm. with family, with our kids, is express the importance of distracted driving, why it's a problem. And certainly when automobiles were created, we didn't have a lot of the gadgets that are being put in them now. And a couple of years ago, I know one of the steps we moved forward on was to prevent inexperienced drivers from using their cell phone in the first 2 years of driving. And so I think you are correct in pointing out that there's a portfolio of options for us, but at the end of the day, I believe that this is a positive step forward, and that's why I've worked on this bill for 5 years now, and I've had the support of former Representative Carla Bingham, Representative Morrow, and on a bipartisan basis, I've worked on this.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Representative Cornish renews his motion that...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
I wanted to offer a comment.
Representative Smith, go ahead.
In listening to the testimony, I support this bill, even at the level of co-authoring it. But I do want to make a point, and that is, looking at the fiscal note, I've heard testimony from my friend, County Attorney Backstrom, 17 filings or 17 potential cases over just a few short years?
Was seven,
Representative Backstrom.
Thank you. In your county, Smith. That's just in your county. Looking at the fiscal note, the $4,000 amount of cost is based on according to the note, based on the assumption that 5% of the drivers, or seven, were charged with this offense. The estimated cost impact is $3,992. Assuming 10% are charged, the cost doubles to near $8,000. I think the fiscal note is telling us it's going to be more than $4,000. My answer is, okay, fine, so what? But my point is, last year, when this committee struggled with, or not struggled, but managed to come up with a budget that met the request of the court system without an increase, there were many hours of hearing and testimony, and the chair at that time had a great struggle, I will use the word struggle, with the executive board that runs the House to even come up to what the request was without an increase, and keep the third branch of government from sustaining cuts. So when we pass a $4,000 fiscal note, which probably will be more, just let's remember whoever's here next year and struggles with the budget then, that when the courts ask for a budget number, let's take a good critical eye and give it to them. So let's be mindful of the fact that this is just one more cost added to the courts when they come in next year and present their budget. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Garofalo.
If I could just make a closing comment. You know, one of the I'm proud to carry this bill, but one of the unfortunate things is that when these tragedies take place in Minnesota, when families go out and look up this item, look up the history of this law, my name pops up, so they call me across the state. And one of the unfortunate things is about every 4 or 5 months I get a call from a new family asking about this. So I just would ask for members' support, and it's the right thing to do, and I do think it's a step in the right direction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And now Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 68 be recommended to pass and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is passed.
Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Representative Cornish. Garofalo. Thank you. Okay. Representative Vogel, are you ready?
I'm ready.
With your bill? All right. Before us now is House File 1899. Representative Vogel, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move my bill to be recommended to pass and go to the House floor, our General Register.
All right. Thank you, Representative Vogel. Proceed with your bill introduction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1899 basically deals with trying to close a small loophole that we have become aware of in the notification of parents when a child is the victim of a crime. And so we're looking to have that when the crime takes place outside of the house, outside of the home. And so what we want to do is just make sure that both parents or guardians are notified in that situation. And it actually stems from a case of a friend of mine from the past. And I have Sarah here who will testify and give a little bit of her story of what brought this case forward.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative Vogel. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Sarah Gugisberg. And in 2001, my husband and I were divorced. We shared three children. The kids went back and forth for visitations like a lot of kids do with divorced parents. In 2005, Jacob was 5 years old. And while visiting his father on the weekend, he was sexually abused by a neighbor. The police did an investigation, and the statutes right now state that a parent must be contacted. I had full custody, and we shared joint legal custody. Investigators went to my ex-husband. He wanted nothing to do with it, and it ended there. in 2009, my son came to me and told me that he was sexually abused. I immediately called law enforcement. They already knew about it. They had investigated. They had prosecuted the abuser because the abuser had abused 10 other children. And for whatever reason, the way the law is written, like I said, it goes, you only have to notify one parent. And it's up to law enforcement if they want to share the information of the abused children with social services. For whatever reason, Lyon County chose not to. So we were never informed. Now, social services would have came in and, you know, they would have talked to Jacob. They would have found out who had custody. I would have been informed in 2005, but instead, after several failed suicide attempts, my son was able to tell us what had happened to him. You know, for whatever reason, my ex-husband decided not to tell me. That was the problem. Law enforcement did not contact me. That was a problem. Social services would, because their best interest is the child. They will not let the child go. If the parent says we want nothing to do with it, they educate the child. They educate the family. And we could have really used that. So basically, this is just to make sure that both parents know and that social services can come in and educate the family as to the impact of sexual abuse, because it affects everybody in the house. We didn't know for years what was wrong with my son. He was depressed. He was angry. Had no idea until he tried killing himself and he told us. So basically, this is just to inform parents so we can get these children some help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gugisberg. Representative Vogel, we have A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move the amendment?
I'd like to move the A3 amendment and have it adopted.
All right. Any discussion on the A3 amendment?
I can address that a little bit, Mr. Chair, just so people know why we're doing that. The A3 amendment stems out of this bill was first heard in public safety, and there were some concerns brought up by MnCASA and the Secretary of State's Safe at Home program as well. And so we worked with them to address their concerns about parents that might be in the under a protective order or in the Safe at Home program. We want to make sure that they remain safe and that they are still sheltered, so that the if there is an order in place that the one parent doesn't have to notify the other, but it would go through the system and help keep them protected. So that's I think we've come to an agreement with all the parties here as to be able to keep everybody safe, but yet make sure that both parents or guardians are notified and they know what's happening in the situation. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do remember Representative Vogel hearing this in public safety, and as you stated, you were going to work on this matter with interested parties, and what you're saying is that you have met with them all, and I see a few of them are in the audience, and everyone's on the same page, and the issue of unintended consequences has been addressed.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Representative Johnson, I believe so. MnCASA and the Secretary of State's office have both been working with us on this, and we've come to an agreement on it. I know that they have given me their okay on this, and in fact, they drew up the language that we have here and came up with it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, great. Representative Vogel renews his motion that the A3 amendment be adopted. Any further discussion? We will proceed to vote on the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the House File 1899 as amended? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel, is there a penalty for a parent who doesn't notify when they're supposed to, or what? How does that get enforced?
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. No, we did not put a penalty in place for that, but we just we're still asking that it will be done. It's through the court order process first of all, and then the other process is that the law enforcement, when this crime is discovered, that they then contact the local welfare social service agency so that they would get involved immediately there. Because in the case of when it happens in the home, it is automatically done at that point. But when it happens from outside the home, evidently that was the problem. It doesn't automatically go to the welfare agency, so then they're not involved.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just to the testifier, what a terrible situation. My heart really goes out to you because, you know, as a parent, it's, you know, hard to imagine how terrible that must be. And I'm fine with the bill. I just want to make the comment that it just shows you how you can't, you know, I hope that this helps. It will help in terms of other people having to be responsible for this. But, boy, you sure can't legislate somebody to be a parent, and you sure can't legislate them to be a decent human being. And, you know, that's really unfortunate. So I hope that we can do something to prevent these kind of things. I'm afraid that, you know, bad parents will always find a way to be bad parents, though.
All right. Any further discussion? If not, we will proceed. Representative Vogel, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew my motion for House File 1899 to be passed and sent to the General Register.
As amended?
As amended.
All right. All in favor of House File 1899, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion, the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Vogel.
Welcome, Mr. Representative Szymanski. You have before us House File 2531, and would you like to move that House file?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House File 2531 be recommended to pass and sent to the Civil Law Committee.
All right, thank you. And I understand you have an amendment as well.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Didn't seem to bring the amendment with me. Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have an A2 amendment that brings the bill into more of the shape that we would like to proceed with on this.
You move that amendment as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the A2 amendment.
Okay. Would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In this in-house file 2531, we're talking about parenting plans. Excuse me. Parenting plans are not a new concept. They've been around for a long time. We've had the Minnesota Supreme Court Parental Cooperation Task Force in our current Minnesota Parenting Plan Statute 518.1705 was passed in the 2000 legislative session. And Minnesota has voluntary parenting plans. The benefits of doing parenting plans instead of our current court process would mean that it would be less adversarial and less conflict for the children. It would have lower costs, less time to complete the divorce process, better outcomes for the parents, better compliance with the terms of the divorce, and a better way to resolve future conflicts. The purpose of this bill is to have a low-cost way to encourage people to develop a parenting plan. Many courts, such as the Court of Appeals, the Civil Court, require parties to use mediation. There are many benefits for using mediation to develop a parenting plan. It saves the parties money. It will take less time than going through the court process, save the court's time, because more people will settle their cases outside of court and it will help settle the cases for pro se litigants. The bill will benefit the courts. The burden on the courts should be diminished. The bill brings relief to the courts. People will settle their cases in mediation and possibly never go to court.
Right, thank you. Are there any questions on the amendment?
Okay.
All those in favor, Representative Champion.
Chair Szymanski, just one question. As I look at this amendment, it appears that the amendment requires for there to be mediation and then possibly early neutral evaluation. So can you tell me the difference between mediation and early neutral evaluation? Because it's my understanding that early neutral evaluation is mediation. And so can you speak to that?
All right. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Szymanski.
May I ask one of our witnesses here to answer that question?
All right. Please identify yourself, please.
I'm Steve Erickson, and I'm a licensed attorney. I am also a mediator. I was here in 1999 and 2000 when Representative Dawkins was one of the sponsors of the original parenting plan bill. And a parenting plan approach to family court basically changes the game. It changes from a contest over who is a better or worse parent when you have a custody dispute to asking the couple to rather build a parenting plan based on a whole range of agreements about location of homes and mediation, and using a parenting plan approach go hand in hand with the parties taking responsibility for creating the future with the help of a mediator. Early neutral evaluation is essentially what it says. It evaluates who's a better or worse parent. It's in the framework of the custody dispute, the 13 best interest test. And so when people end up in an early neutral evaluation, they are not at all in mediation. They're in an evaluative, adjudicative process that determines who's a better or worse parent. And so they are immediately placed into a contest or an evaluative approach. Mediation is not like that. I don't evaluate as a mediator. I ask the people to cooperate together to sort of change the game from contesting and headbutting each other into who's a better or worse parent, who's going to get the children, to the question becomes in the mediation room, what are the future parenting arrangements we can help you build so you can be cooperative? It's a very different game changer approach.
Representative Champion.
Just one follow-up. I practice in this area of law, and in fact, I just had an early neutral evaluation last week. And it's been my experience, and this is still speaking to this amendment, that the parties all sit down and they talk about what they would like to see as parents, what their thoughts are about a shared custody arrangement as well as a parenting access schedule, and that's done in the presence of a neutral evaluator who isn't evaluating them in order to determine who's the best or worst parent, but it is a process by which folks can talk through their issues so that they can be parents going forward. And so I just think that this particular amendment adds another layer of bureaucracy onto the whole process. If you are going to now say someone has to mediate, and then there's the possibility also of the early neutral evaluation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Szymanski.
Yeah, this gentleman testify on that question.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Brad Hattie. I am also a practicing attorney in Minnesota in the area of family law. And I do understand the comments just made and would tell you that as many good E&E processes, there have been just as many bad ones. The E&E process is not nearly as neutral as we would all like to hope. It is an extension of the court, and it is an attempt to try to resolve a situation by removing it off of the court, the court's calendar, which is all excellent. We'd like to reduce the load of our courts any time. I will tell you, however, that it is an evaluative process. The evaluators, while neutral, are there to try to listen to some information and then determine to tell the parties what they think the court is going to do. And there are two attorneys there representing both parties unless they're pro se. By allowing 2 hours of mediation for these parties without attorneys in the way will allow them to see, maybe for the first time and only time, that there are truly alternatives to the court system, a way to reach a resolution without having to see such an adversarial system, because we are all striving for the best interests of the children. The other thing that's very important to consider is that once this is in an ICMC, or initial case management conference, where E&E has been scheduled, relief for either of the parties must be stayed until after the E&E process. There are parties that truly need either temporary housing or temporary financial support, where a mediator, if listening to this in the first 2 hours, can reach that agreement. We have all done things, not only this state, but several states, to remove the hurdles and the barriers to obtaining a divorce and dissolution. To ask that 2 hours be put in front of the parties to see a true alternative, to me, is not excessive and is going to provide an excellent benefit to these parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hattie. I'm sorry, Representative Champion.
To the testifiers, for clarity, so are you saying that under this particular bill that 2 hours of mediation will help clarify and resolve many of the issues that families would have when they come into the marital dissolution system? Well, is that your testimony?
That is my testimony, that it has that opportunity, and it has an opportunity to go well beyond the 2 hours and to resolve everything in a mediated settlement.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Chairman.
Yeah, just a follow-up. And so isn't mediation non-binding?
The parties have to agree. Early neutral evaluation is also non-binding. Now, all I'm saying is that they're two distinct, very different processes. And the parties have to agree to either one.
Just a follow-up. It's my understanding that the testifier indicated that before the initial case management conference occurred, mediation can happen before that. And so I'm not sure in the process how that's true and how you get the parties to agree. If a case has already been filed, there's been no judge involvement at all, and so the process appears to, again, this bill appears to add on another layer that is not necessary.
My name is Marilyn McKnight, and I'm a mediator with Erickson Mediation Institute, and have been a professional family mediator since 77, 35 years. And have taught mediators, have traveled this country and other countries teaching mediation, particularly in family. Family mediation is an extremely successful way for people getting divorced to come to agreements and really have better outcomes than they have in litigation or in the adversarial process. The adversarial process from the beginning has people in a sense being alienated from each other from the beginning, told that they shouldn't speak together to each other, and various kinds of advice. The research in divorce mediation has been extensive, and the research shows that when people mediate their divorces, the outcomes for children are much better. And I think that Minnesota ought to join 13 states that have mandatory mediation and ought to begin to serve the divorcing families. In doing that, Minnesota will save a lot of money from court. You can look at Tennessee. Tennessee, 4th District, Tennessee, as early as 1988, the Tennessee legislature authorized pilot co-parenting mediation programs in 6 judicial districts to develop parenting agreements. The success of the pilot programs was striking. Parents concentrated on writing good contracts for the sharing of their parents. their children post-divorce and returns to court after divorce were drastically reduced. The present law in Tennessee requires a minimum of 4 hours of mediation, each of which shall take place on a different day and is required before mediation can be deemed to have failed. The requirement is inflexible. It won't be waived, even at the request of the mediator. The success obtained in maybe in less than 4 hours, and the mediation may end with all issues resolved before four sessions have been completed. The research about the success of divorce mediation is extensive. Divorce mediation has been researched since the 80s, early 80s. One of the greatest effects of mediated divorce has been to lessen the negative impact of divorce on children. One of the most repeated research results has been that the conflict between parents is most harmful to children, and that has come from the first study, Surviving the Breakup, 1983, Joan Kelly, Judy Wallerstein. You can read the book. It is unbelievable. And they have been supported. That research has been supported in all research since then. According to Robert Emery, who's a PhD, a divorce mediation expert, professor of psychology, and director of the Center for Children, Families, and the Law at the University of Virginia, researcher and author, he reports that divorce is almost always stressful for children. Divorce can also strain parent-child relationships, lead to lost contact with one parent, create economic hardships, and increase conflict between parents. Divorce clearly increases the risk that children will suffer from psychological and behavioral problems. Most children from divorced families are resilient, especially when their parents do a reasonably good job managing the stress of the divorce. Many resilient children still report painful memories and ongoing worries about divorce, their relationships with their parents, and their parents' relationships with each other. Parents can promote their children's resilience and do much to ease their pain. A 12-year longitudinal study shows a lot. His study is written in the book, The Truth About Children and Divorce, and I would invite all of you to take a look at that book, and it's summarized also on his website. But the findings are that mediation kept most families out of court. Less than 25% of them went to court in his study. His study was a group of families and from the courts who were who had filed for contested custody hearings. He used random assignment. These people went to the adversarial process. These people went to mediation. And it was a longitudinal study. He followed his families for 12 years. What he learned is that if they mediated, they stayed out of court. 75% of the families that went to the adversarial process ended up going before a judge. The people who went to mediation, 20% ended up before a judge. Even when mediation failed, parents tended to settle out of court with the help of their lawyers. Angry families, what happens when they leave a mediator's office and years later? Even then, 5 hours of mediation caused non-residential parents to see their children much more often 12 years later. So they stayed in relationship much longer in the mediated settlements. They dropped off considerably to 28% for the non-residential and adversarial divorces. changes in telephone contact. I could go on with the changes. I'd be glad to have this report copied and all of you to see that. But the truth is that when people are first introduced to mediation, before they get into a court process, they are highly successful. Most of the divorces that I do are people who don't want to go to court, don't want to be into the adversarial system, and they mediate their divorces before ever doing that, and they go to court only in a default hearing, pro se, not represented by lawyers at all, and lawyers are now in unbundled services, will do Scrivener work for those people and will draft very, very good legal documents for them to file with the court.
Thank you, Ms. McKnight. I just want to remind the members that we are still discussing the amendment, the A2 amendment, and so questions and comments, we'd like to keep confined to that. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I do have perhaps a two-part question on the amendment. First of all, I'm not going to offer my opinion on this bill or this amendment, but if I were to offer my opinion, I would suggest a reminder here that looking at the fiscal note from the previous bill, the cost of a judge unit is $351,000 in fiscal year 13. Now, that's not the judge's salary. It includes the judge's salary and the staff and so forth necessary to have a judge sitting in a courthouse. One could raise the question, who better to mediate divorcing couples short of having a trial than the judge? Looking at the amendment, it's dated March 6th. I'm looking at, in my packet at least, a Republican Research Committee brief dated March 5th, the day before this amendment. Keep that in mind. My first question is to the mediators. I see at least two or three mediators in front of me, and I notice the brief suggests that supporters include mediators. What is your hourly fee, and what is the average hourly fee for a mediator in this state? Mr. Erickson.
The hourly fees of the mediators are consistent with the hourly fees of the attorneys. I am a mediator. In fact, I'm missing a Court of Appeals conference call case. I'm one of the 12 mediators that was involved in the pilot project. And I suggested to the appellate court when they were setting the program up that the mediator's fees be commensurate with the lawyer's fees. So when they require parties to be in mediation through the appellate court project, now every case that's appealed, it's a family court case, has to be in mandatory mediation. The mediator's fees are set at one half of the two attorneys' fees. So if each attorney's fees are $250 an hour for each attorney, the mediator gets $125 from one side and $125 from the other. So the mediator's fee is one half in the court mandatory project. It's one half of what the lawyer's fee is, so you add them together and it's equal, so it's equivalent. So the mediator's fees never exceed what the lawyers charge. And on those cases where they're in forma pauperis, the mediator's fee is set at $20 an hour. And so in a mandatory program, it has to be that way, where the fees are commensurate with the parties. And many of the programs in Tennessee, Washington, they have a list of mediators, and the mediators must be willing to give pro bono and free work. And as to your question about the judge, judges are good at judging, and some may be good mediators, but when the parties get into the courtroom, they're looking for somebody to make the decision for them. The beauty of the parenting plan legislation is that it empowers the parties to take charge of their own lives. When I, as a mediator, say, well, I don't know what's the best schedule for you, why don't I help you create some alternatives, let's try some, let's practice, the people begin to take responsibility for the problem. The whole purpose of getting people out of court is to say to them they should take responsibility, and the mediator is trained to help them take responsibility. Lawyers, judges, and early neutral evaluators are essentially trained to help them understand what the outcome might be in court. I'd rather work with them on what the outcome could be to better their children on their terms, their schedules, rather than an evaluator. And I think that's what Mr. Hattie was pointing out in some of the cases that I know I've had that you've been involved in, Brad. Once the court makes its determination at the early neutral evaluation, once the evaluator says, oh, I think you're not going to prevail on that 50-50 timesharing, or I don't think you're going to prevail on your request for sole custody, or maybe you will, once it's predicted, the die is set and it's hard to get them back into a cooperative mode. And that was the thinking, I think, behind saying, why don't you try mediation first? And as to whether it adds another layer, I think the courts are always trying to add layers to get people to try to settle because there's fewer and fewer resources. So if the layers are properly thought out and if the layers are successful, then the only people that benefit are the courts.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Erickson. I'm not trying to be rude. In fact, I like you. I've
been in your office, and I appreciate your work.
And I've been in your office with a client many years ago on a mediation case. And you're a good lawyer and a good mediator, and you just took over 5 minutes to answer a question that would have required a dollar hourly rate fee. And you did a good job in confusing me and getting me off track, but I can get back on track. I do have a serious question here. Relative to the timing of this brief that says the Minnesota to the author, the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women are opponents, according to this March 5th brief in my packet, and yet the amendment is dated one day later. Is the Coalition Battered Women still opposing this, and have they seen the amendment? Have they weighed in? Because what I'm looking at is the opponents being the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. How has that changed with your day after amendment?
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith, I have not heard from the Coalition of Battered Women other than the sheet that was handed out with our packets today. Well, we have that in our packets.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then, so I can assume the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women are still in opposition to this bill.
I would have to ask them to speak on that issue.
Can I speak to that? Just every mediator has mandatory training in screening for domestic violence. And the cases that come into mediation where there has been domestic violence, they have been successfully mediated in our practice. And there hasn't been a recurrence of violence afterwards or during the mediation process. Compare that with a court process where lawyers are not mandatorily trained, not even in family law, but much less in domestic violence. So they don't screen for it. They don't necessarily know it exists. And we have 30 women killed every year by their partner or spouse. I mean, I think mediators take such huge precautions and really understand what domestic violence is to such a greater extent that people are safer in the mediation process. We set up very strict protocols when there's domestic violence where the abused person wants to mediate. If the abused person doesn't want to mediate, we mediators do not mediate those cases and refer them to lawyers who are knowledgeable about domestic violence and will handle them.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. I have no further questions on the amendment, but I will have some comments when we discuss this bill.
All right, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification on early neutral evaluation. I understand mediation and its point and purpose. In the early neutral evaluation, does that entail a written recommendation to the judge regarding how things should be worked out based on the criteria, best interest of the child? Or how does it, I'm not clear on how it differs from mediation.
Mr. Hattie?
I believe it's fair to say that the only written report that you're going to receive from a neutral to a court would be if there's an agreement. The same, I believe, with a mediator. If the parties don't agree, the court generally is not going to be interested in finding out why they didn't agree.
Representative Johnson.
Just a procedural question, I guess, for the Chair Szymanski, as assuming this amendment goes on and the bill moves forward to civil law, it's my understanding once we get a fiscal note, it'll come back to judiciary, is that correct?
That is my preference, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
I'd like to speak to that fiscal note. I read the paper. When people do parenting plans, they don't end up in front of the judge to do the parenting plan. And what has happened in other states is that mandatory mediation has decreased court costs. So the fiscal note, I think, is not well informed. So I just need to say that.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, if I may.
Representative Smith.
That's an accurate statement. But part of the reason the courts, the third branch of government, has been looking for ways to cut that judge unit time or make better use of it in actual trials is because the third branch of government simply hasn't been receiving the kind of funding they should have over the last few decades. So they are looking for ways to cut costs.
Right.
And expanding what should be in a courtroom and heard and mediated by a judge is now being done by hundreds of other faces.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a this is cost-driven, bottom line. I'm through, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for ranting.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think we all agree that divorce is stressful and that mediation is good, but this seems to be about a law that orders a judge to immediately require everyone to pay for it, whether they need it or not. So I see the amendment has, unless the parents have developed a written parenting plan or have reached an agreement regarding custody and parenting time. And I would understand from other testimony we've had on other bills that at least 95%, if not more, are able to do that themselves. So my question for this is, how can they just say that we've reached an agreement? Do they just say to the judge, yeah, we've reached an agreement? Because my concern is that it does add another layer if this isn't clear, and that I have a friend that does early nuptial evaluation, and I believe it was defined by him more like Representative Champion described it than the testifier did, so I have great respect for it. I'm wondering if it's another layer that's not necessary and that has to be paid by the parents. So my question is whether they need it or not. How easy is it to tell the judge, yeah, we have an agreement?
A parenting plan is a written document that is presented as part of the divorce decree, and so that's where it would be found.
Representative Lane.
The amendment says have developed a written parenting plan or have reached an agreement regarding custody and parenting time. How does the or have reached an agreement regarding custody and parenting time get established?
If they already have an agreement, then apparently they have a divorce that is settled and being presented to the court.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. I don't think that's what I get from this. This is part of the whole thing is that the court shall immediately enter an order for the parties to attend 2 hours of mediation unless there's an agreement. Well, so I'm unclear. Maybe you're not, as a mediator, you're not the one to be asking. I probably should be asking Representative Smith.
Mr. Hattie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand the question, the parties are at some point either pro se or with their attorneys in front of the court for an ICMC, which is the initial case management conference. At that time, the judge asks if there are any issues outstanding that need to be decided, either through a social neutral or a financial neutral. The parties could at that time come to the court and say that we have an agreement on the social or parenting plan side of it, and that would resolve it and therefore not need the neutrals or the mediator.
Okay. Members and testifiers, we have about 17 more minutes and there are more testifiers on this bill, so I'd ask that we confine our comments to the amendment. We'll try to get this amendment voted on within the next 5 minutes and then move on to other testifiers. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just want to comment. I think there's some drafting errors in this amendment. I think it was probably pretty hastily put together, and just Representative Chemanski in the very first sentence, line 1.4, you should just take another look at that for pure drafting. But substantively, my question relates to, on the amendment, line 1.8 and 1.9, I'm really unclear about why that's being structured that way. Neither as an exemption to this requirement that neither party can afford mediation. I mean, what if one party can't afford it? And then why exempting people if a party has authorization to proceed in forma pauperis? I'm just not understanding why you would exempt, why that's being done. Secondly, I just want to say that You know, I don't think anybody around this table disagrees that it's good if people can agree, and we want to get that happening. So, you know, all the time we spent this morning talking about how good it is if people can agree, I think, you know, in some respects I would guess that the testifiers are preaching to the converted on that. However, the question is, you know, how do we get there? And that's why we need to really dig into this these proposed bills. So, so my other question about this amendment is whether this amendment, or maybe the bill once the amendment goes on, will change what's already happening in some courts, because we know that some courts like mine in Olmsted County are really moving and have moved a long way toward getting the conflict out of the court. And so I'm just not sure if how putting this in place, you know, is this mandating something different than what they're already doing? You know, obviously this would standardize some practice across the state. That's, I hope you understand what my question is there.
Yeah, I think Representative
Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. You know, the section one of the bill that talks about the Supreme Court's judicial education program will include ongoing parenting plan training for the district court judges. That I think that kind of gets to part of the you know, normalizing the process across the state. And as far as the, you know, what you'd refer to, you know, some potential modifications in the drafting of the amendment, you know, we would take that under advisement and have that cleaned up before we go to the next committee hearing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Representative Szymanski, my substantive question, though, is about this the exemption. If neither party can afford mediation or a party has authorization to proceed in a forum of pauperis, why not exempt them if one of the parties, what happens if one of the parties can't afford mediation? And why in the world exempt people who are authorized to proceed?
Representative Liebling, I can answer your question. This part of the amendment was offered to us from Legal Aid, and they want to just make sure that people that can't afford mediation are found as being in forma pauperis would not be required to do mediation. So these people are being opted out of the requirement of having to use mediation. If one party can afford the mediation, then that party will pay for it. Otherwise, if someone is in forma pauperis, they will not be required to do mediation. And this is from the Legal Aid one of this in the bill.
I'd like to remind members to go through the chair, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. But really, your answer just tells me who wants it and what the thing says. I want to know why.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
Representative Lee, so that people that can't afford it will not be ordered into the 2 hours of mediation. These are the exceptions to the, these are all the people that will not be required to do the 2 hours. And also number five says that if they find that mediation is unnecessary or harmful, so in case of the domestic abuse cases, if they do not want to do the 2 hours, they can also opt out. So this is all the people that do not have to be required to do the 2 hours of mediation.
Representative Liebman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I give up. I can't vote for an amendment that nobody can explain to me why it's doing what it's doing. And, you know, I also, you know, Representative Szymanski, one more try here, if you can even answer that question, or my other question, which is, you know, is this upsetting procedure? And I'm not talking about the Section 1 of the bill. I'm talking about the amendment. Is this going to change practice in some courts that are already doing this pretty successfully? That's what I'm, you know, I guess we need to know a little more about what's going on in the various districts around the state. But those are my questions.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, I must apologize. I do not spend time in the courtroom, and I cannot answer, you know, for the courts in that regard. But we would anticipate that the benefits of this bill would be that we do ease the burden on the courts in the divorce proceedings, and in that process, you know, bring the divorce, the parties to a divorce, to the courts, you know, better prepared to, you know, settle things amicably rather than, you know, in contested issues before the bench. that you don't look like you're satisfied by that answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really frustrating to me, Representative Shemansky. I understand that you're not necessarily the expert on these matters, but you have testifiers here, or you did. I mean, the issue isn't that we don't agree on the goals. The issue is we need to make sure the mechanics are right.
Mr. Hattie, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure if I understand the question. So if you wouldn't mind, please, Representative, repeating one more time.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. Maybe we should just, I can talk to people about this offline. Let me try one more time since you came to the table. Basically, two questions. One is why we're not, if we're going to exempt people when neither of them can afford mediation, why are we not exempting them when one person can't afford it, one of the parties can't? And then why in the world would we exempt people who are authorized to proceed in form of pauperis? That's one question. And the second one is, does this change procedure in courts that are already settling a lot of cases using alternative procedures and doing this very well already?
To answer your second question first, I don't believe, as a practicing attorney, that it's going to upset current procedures. I think that the court's attempt to address Representative Smith's comment as well, in that judges don't want to make these decisions, so that they're looking for any source to help them in making a decision regarding a dissolution and or custody issues. So whatever system is in place is helping the court to avoid making that decision without significant help, whether it be through the early neutral evaluation program or, in this case, a mediation. Mediation, early neutral, any other alternative dispute, or no alternative resolution, if parties can reach an agreement, is going to help the court move these things along faster. So I don't believe that this is going to alter or impose any greater imposition on the court to have it in place. The courts are going to continue to have the ICMC, and they're going to ask whether or not there are issues outstanding between the parties, and then they're going to attempt to find a way to resolve it. One of the things the mediation does that the EME does not do is that it provides the parties with an opportunity to learn how to co-parent going forward, and that custody issues are 18 more years. Now, back to your first question, the bill is attempting to provide, in my opinion, my humble opinion, alternatives. Divorces today allow for parties to pay for them in a number of ways. If one party can't afford it over another party, then the party that can afford it can sometimes be levied legal fees for both parties. Some parties can file in form of pauperis, which allows them to file a petition, which means that they don't have to pay to have their petition heard before the court, as you know. This is just allowing individuals an opportunity, I believe, to opt out should they not be able to afford it. And because of that, it's giving individuals the greatest amount of freedom to make decisions in their dissolution going forward. And it's also providing, and more importantly, I think, an alternative to the current system, which doesn't really provide them the neutral that they think that they're getting.
Members, I think what we will do here is take a vote on the A2 amendment and then hear from our other testifiers, and then we'll lay over this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Shemansky.
The lady beside me here would like to comment on the question before us.
On the amendment question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services. I just wanted to be clear because the question came up and Representative Anderson indicated there was involvement by us, which is accurate. But I wanted everybody to be clear what our request was. The language about if neither party can afford it was already in the language of the bill. We simply approached Representative Anderson and said, because of the dynamic of how the bill mechanics seem to work, we don't want people who can't afford mediation to kind of be stuck in this loop where they can't move forward. And so we asked her, we knew there were a lot of other people involved in kind of the bigger issues of the bill, to at least simply exempt out the informal pauperous people because they wouldn't likely be able to pay a mediator in large scale anyway. to be honest, that's the reality for our clients, is they, in large part, do not get private mediation.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. We will take a vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Amendment passes. We have other testifiers on this bill. House File 2531 as amended. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, my name is Andrea Nemi. I am a lawyer and a mediator in the Twin Cities. I've been a mediator for 22 years. I'm the former chair of the Minnesota Alternative Dispute Resolution Ethics Board. I'm on the Court of Appeals Mediation Panel. I was on the pilot for that. I'm a mediator on that panel, and I was recently named the best mediator in Minneapolis by Best Lawyers in America for 2012. I want to start out by telling you that I am a huge supporter of parenting plans, and I have mediated dozens of parenting plans. I do have some concerns about this proposed legislation. I believe that mediation as an ADR process must remain voluntary. Our General Rules of Practice, Rule 114, says that mediation is a voluntary process. This bill makes it non-voluntary. It mandates that people go to mediation. I'm going to point out to you that the E&E process that everybody's talking about is also a voluntary process. No one has to go to the E&E process. They are given the option when they have their initial case management conference with the court, but no one has to participate in E&E. My experience with let me go back here. I also I'm concerned about requiring mediation before the E&E process. I am also an E&E provider, and I believe that it's a process that works exceptionally well. Not just believe, it does work exceptionally well. We have the statistics to prove it. It does have a facilitative aspect to it, as mediation is a facilitative process. It is not an adjudicative process. Evaluators do provide their opinion on what might happen in court, or also what might be in the children's best interest. But my experience with E&E is most of the time I'm spending listening to the parties and helping them work out an agreement, more akin to mediation than to being in front of a judge and getting a decision. Nothing's imposed on people in the E&E process. I also will tell you that 2 hours of mediation is not enough time to work out a comprehensive parenting plan. My experience is that it takes at least 6 hours. If the parenting plan you're looking for is the parenting plan that's required by the minimum parenting plan in the parenting plan statute, which says that a parenting plan has to include a schedule, a parenting time schedule, a decision-making plan, or how people are going to make decisions about their children, and a plan for how they're going to resolve disputes in the future. Most custody orders that I see coming out of a court today would qualify as a parenting plan. The parenting plans that I have mediated get into great detail. We have to spend a lot of time listening to people, their concerns, understand, they need to talk to each other about their concerns. Decision-making can become a long discussion about how they're going to handle decision-making. We talk about communication. We talk about things like how are they going to handle moving out of the local area if somebody needs to move. We can get into great detail. You can't do that in 2 hours.
Thank you, Ms. Nemi. Members, we are at the end of our allotted time. This bill will be laid over for future consideration. Representative Szymanski, any final comments before we adjourn?
Well, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, you know, it was good that we could air this bill out today to, you know, look at the, you know, the little tweaking that we need to do to, you know, to satisfy a lot of the concerns brought up in our committee hearing today. And we will continue to work on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Szymanski. This bill. I'd be happy to, if it's short testimony. Is there anyone else that wants to make a short comment on this this bill before we adjourn? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair.
We are Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to pass the bill to civil law and not lay it over, and let Representative Ms. Szymanski work on the concerns between now and the civil law committee.
It's the chair's determination that this will be laid over.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.